interesting, I think one very interesting thing about that is that in 1918, you see, World War I was still on. And of course, there were all sorts of stories about the atrocious things that Germans were doing to children. And that we had Germans in this country who were poisoning children by offering them candy and so on. And we got into Baltimore, my father and mother, and four very small children. The youngest one of whom was just, I think, about 2 months old. And my great-grandfather and great-grandmother for them to take care of, too. And we had to come across to the station to get on the Montauk Railroad to ride up here. And some old lady apparently saw all these children, you know, and wanted to be especially nice to us. And she offered me a bar of candy, and I wouldn't take it. And my mother sort of slipped me off to the side and said, "That isn't very courteous." And I said, "But Mommy, don't you know they're poisoning children all over this place?" So I took the candy and I ate it. And of course, I didn't learn until years and years afterwards that the cause of my migraine headaches was largely chocolate. And I upchucked from Baltimore into Pilesville, partly because of the candy and partly because of the swaying of the Montauk Railroad, you know. So I was the sickest little girl you ever saw when we got into Pilesville. And my grandfather met us there with two horses hooked to a surrey. And my uncle also had a surrey. I think he had two small mules hooked to that. I can't really remember the second surrey, but I know it took two surreys to get us all from the station at Pilesville up to my grandfather's farm. But when we came through the thing, and you wonder why a child would be so interested in that. When we came through the rocks and the train was swaying across that trestle and weaving around all those awful looking places, I remembered that my Uncle Lee Linkus had written to tell us that we really ought to sell our farm down there in Tazewell County and come up here and buy some of this beautiful level land. Well, not when I was in the rocks, I thought we'd been conned. So it was an interesting trip. My grandfather had been here about 2 years, and they had left Tazewell with them all of their possessions. They brought everything up here, and to do it, they had to get some kind of special car for the horses. But we were warned not to do that because you could buy them here cheaper than you could bring them up here, you see. So mm-hmm. We just brought household things. Mm-hmm. And we spent an awful lot of time getting ready to get into the new house. My mother wanted to go over and get it all new to us, that is. She wanted to get it all straightened up. And my second brother was—he was always a great mama's boy, and he wanted to go with her. And she said, "No, you can't do that because I'm going to be cleaning all day." And Grandma said, "Oh, Rex, you come and stay with me, and we'll just have a real good time." And as children, we were always taught that you never took anything at the table until some grown-up handed it to you, you know, and it was called passing your plate, and you passed your plate for whatever you wanted. And if you didn't do that, if you just reached over to take something out of a dish, the grown-ups called it dishing in, and dishing in was a cardinal sin in our family. You just didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So when Rex saw he was going to have to stay with Grandma anyhow, he said, "Well, if I stay with you, Grandma, will you have apple butter and let me dishy?" We used to have a big thing. Mealtime was a big thing when I was a child, and of course the first order of everything was that you waited until grace was said. And this same brother Rex was a little impatient one time because Grandpa had waited longer to say grace than he thought he ought to. Rex was about, he might have been four, but I think he was much more than three. And we were all sitting around waiting for Grandpa to bow his head and say grace, and he didn't do it. And finally Rex turned around and looked at him and said, "Grandpa, please hurry up and talk to your plate so we can start to eat." And of course, you know, in those days, mealtime was a much bigger thing than it is now because the whole family gathered around it. You didn't have somebody off to a ball game and somebody else off to something else. Meals took the greater part of an hour. And you sat around the table, and children were not excused from the table until the grown-ups left. You sat there until the meal was all completed. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think the thing that makes many of these memories so vivid to me, you see, is that we were moving into a brand new location where everything was going to be quite different than it had been before. One of the big things that I was thinking of in connection with school I think the compulsory school laws came into Maryland about 1916. I'm not real sure about that date, but it was around that time, I think. And of course, we came here in 1918, which meant that all the school systems were real gung-ho to get everybody in school every day, you know. And we just thought, my soul, this was the strangest thing, because we had a lot of company from Virginia. And you didn't just dash off and leave your company. If company came, you stayed on another day. So I'm sure we missed more days than we were supposed to, because every time company came up from Virginia, all the kids wanted to stay home and stay with them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, school itself was... I gave a talk the other day over to that Genesee school over, I think it's close to Reisterstown. They have a fascinating kind of setup there. They have a ratio of 3 children to a teacher. Mm. And it's from children who have learning disabilities, but they're very, very smart kids. Mm-hmm. So when they asked me to talk, the person who introduced me said they were introducing somebody who had lived quite a long time and was going to talk to them about things that they really didn't know much about. And I said, well, in a way I am, because I've seen many, many big changes in my life, but there's one thing I've seen no change in, and that's kids. They're just the same as they always were. So the thing that was so strange to us coming here, you see, was that we came up here calling a brown paper bag that we took our lunch to school in, a poke. And if we referred to the poke, the kids all giggled. And we called our parents Mama and Papa. And everybody up here was saying Mom and Pop. And the kids all giggled when we talked about our family. And dozens of other words like that. There were a lot of words that we were pronouncing when we came here, just exactly the way the Elizabethan English people had, because that section of Appalachia had been settled by people who just hadn't moved out of there, and they had gone in the time of Queen Elizabeth, and they were still talking the way my great aunt never referred to more than one post as anything but posties. See the inflected ending? Mm-hmm. And a lot of our words were like that. So this was real game for the kids when we moved in, you know. This was big fun to hear us talk. And I know the first, I haven't been here very long until a cousin of ours came up to visit us. And he listened to me. I had always talked faster than most youngsters, whether they were here or there. But he listened to me for about 5 minutes and he said, "Don't you know your folks are going to be so ashamed of you because you don't talk like home at all?" And I suppose I was trying very hard, you know, to lose the accent that I lost very, very soon after we came here and was always a little sorry about. The only time you ever hear it in me now is if I get very upset or very mad about something. If I get very mad when I start to say anything with an E and it comes out IN. And the youngsters used to say at school when I was teaching that they'd always tell them Miss Wiley lost her temper because if she was saying, "Superintendent, you better sit down and behave yourself." So I guess that our recollections are more vivid because of the change from where we were to here. Another thing, the superstitions that were here just fascinated me. You know, we didn't have any. We didn't believe in Friday the 13th, and we didn't believe in Black Cat Cross New Path, and we didn't believe in any of those things. And when we came here, I just couldn't get over. If somebody started out to go on a trip, they would turn around and come back and sit down and count to 3. No, to 10, I believe. It was a long count, seems to me, before they would start again, because if you didn't, you were going to have some kind of trouble. The only superstition that I ever recall ever knowing about when I was a child was that people believed that if 2 persons that you knew died, there would be the 3rd death. And people that I knew believed that if a rooster crowed in the night, there would be a death. The only 2 superstitions I knew about were connected with death. But when we got up here, there was superstition about everything. We had whooping cough the first year we were here, and this neighbor of ours, a lovely person, a good soul, and one of the best neighbors in the world, came up and she listened to us going around the house a whooping and a coughing and going on, and she said, Now, Miss Hankins, if you'll just take those children out and find a raspberry vine that has grown up and down and then rerooted in the ground over here so that it makes an arc, and if you'll poke each one of them through that arc, the whooping cough won't hurt them. And then she had gone on and said, I don't expect it would. If I take you out in the middle of the winter like this to poke you through a raspberry vine, you'd die as the whooping cough could hurt you. So this was, of course, when we came here, there were lots of people who believed in powwowing and who believed in that the, what was it, the seventh son of the seventh son could stop blood from flowing, and just all sorts of things that I'd never heard of. I have a collection of them. I may sometime redo the Harford County ghost stories and add all those old folk superstitions to them. I'm sort of thinking about that, but we were just constantly amazed at the things that were so new to us. All the planting was done in signs. You, if you wanted a good garden, you planted in a certain sign. Just so much of, it seemed to me as a child that so much of their whole lives would be controlled by the things that they believed and had heard for generations and generations. But outside of that, I think most of the things, the language was a big difference, and of course the beliefs were a big difference, but then outside of that we were just, I could not find too many things. The first two teachers that I had when I came here were very like the one that I had in Virginia, except they treated me a lot better, because I was a snippy little soul when I was in first grade in Virginia, and I'm sure that what I thought was just answering came out sounding smart, because I know one time the teacher, a friend of mine, was sitting in front of me, and she had a big white ribbon tied on her braids in the back, and it slid into the floor, and I picked it up and put it on top of her head, and the teacher made me stand in the corner. And when she thought I had stood there long enough, she said, well, are you ready to sit down now? And I said, well, I really don't know about that. And so she made me stand a little longer. So then a few days we had a spelling class, and she asked me to spell cake. And I spelled C-K-E-A. And she said, you left out a letter. And I said, I know I did, but I went back and got it. So you see, that kind of flippancy probably caused her not to like me very well. I didn't like her very well, but when we came here, I had Miss Viola Strawbridge the first year, and she was just fantastic. She was good to me, and she was also a thorough teacher. She's still living, by the way. She's in a nursing home over at Coralville. I think she's had three strokes now, and is completely incapacitated, but I went to see her last summer. And then we had Miss Grace Doherty after that, who was just such a perfect lady, that they made such big impressions on me. So I thought school was a real wonderful place, especially after Miss Grace taught me to use the encyclopedia. After I would get through doing the things that I had to do, I just was idle for the, you know, when you had seven grades in the room. So Miss Grace taught me to use the encyclopedia, and I just spent all my time reading the encyclopedia. And school was, it was a fun thing, because everybody knew everybody. And that class to which I came as a small child, the people are still living here in the neighborhood, and only a few of them have died, and I think only two of them had died until 2 years ago, and there have been about four since then. But they were all neighborhood people, and everybody knew everybody else, and if some kid got out of line, some other kid put him back in line. And you didn't have the kinds of problems that we think of now, because there are so many strangers. Now, is that the sort of thing you want, or do you want to,
us
to vary the kind of...
No.
Well, when I was, 13, I had appendicitis. And I didn't go back to school that year, because I had finished the seventh grade. And of course, at that time, more kids didn't go on to school from seventh grade than did. But my mother said she wanted to be sure that I went back to school the next year, so they put me in the seventh grade. She sent me to the seventh grade the rest of that year to finish out after I got able to go back. And then I went to Highland for 4 years, beginning with the eighth grade. And at that time, nobody had ever heard of any such thing as a field trip, you know. You didn't take students all over the world on a field trip. They sat in there and they had a book in front of them and they did what they were supposed to do. But Helen Jones, who later married one of the Galbraiths from Highland, Helen Jones Galbraith, was certainly a forward-looking teacher because she used to load us up into this little old automobile that she had. It was, I don't know, but it had two seats in it anyway. And her whole science class could get in the car. And she took us wherever there was something she thought we ought to see. We went up to see the Holtwood Dam, and we went to the rocks to look at rock formation, and out to the creamery at Pilesville, and all kinds of places that up to that time people thought, well, mercy, what are these kids doing here? And then Hazel Wolbeck, who later married Lyle Moles from Forest Hill, was also, she was my English teacher, and she was another forward-looking person because she dramatized everything she taught us. She was a very dramatic person herself, and she could just make everything come alive. And I remember one time we were doing Ivanhoe, and we had decided that we were going to costume for it. Well, right now, girls are wearing the same kind of skirts that were very stylish in those days. They're a sort of knife pleated job, and they were called butterfly skirts at that time. They're a sort of knife pleated and very full at the bottom, but cinched into almost nothing at the waist. And I don't know how we ever managed to do it, but somehow we talked Dave Harry and Jim Jones, who were the only two boys in the class, into wearing these for kilts. I don't know. And we were really emoting over it. We were just making Ivanhoe the most fantastic thing you ever saw. And in walked the state superintendent of schools. And this was way back to, I think it was Dr. Cook, it was way, way back. But we just went right on emoting, and after the class was over, I remember that he said to her in front of us that this was certainly the most interesting class he'd observed in the state. And I don't know whether it was before or after that that she had us dramatizing The Ancient Mariner. And whichever person had the loudest voice and could weigh on the most ham usually was picked for a reader. And because I had a foghorn voice and was always a ham, I usually got the reading part. And that meant that I could see all the performers and see what they were doing. And Ella Laird and Thelma Kent were going to be the corpse, you know, about the corpse that lay on the the deck as the ship sailed the molten sea. And right in the middle of my dramatic reading about the corpse and for a frozen corpse was he and all this rigmarole stuff, Ella lifted her head up and peered around to see what everybody was doing. It just about brought the house down. So we had a very good kind of school relationship, and that's really proven by the fact that the Highland Alumni Association is still, in spite of the fact that we've had no new people in since 50, you know, because mm-hmm. that was the last class graduating, it's still a very active once a year reunion that never has less than 100 people and sometimes has nearly 300 back in attendance. And they have just this close-knit kind of thing that I think is the only thing that I ever worry about our losing. Like I say, because I always was a kind of ham, I usually got a part in every senior, well, I did get a part in every senior play from the time I was a freshman till I was graduated. And that, it was quite a task, you know, for somebody to get a child from up here at Five Forks all the way to Highland for practice for two weeks. That's all Miss Hazel ever practiced. You had that play ready in 2 weeks or you just didn't put it on. And it was quite a job to get somebody down there for that. And the people in the neighborhood, knowing how far I had to come, would have their children invite me to come to their house to stay the nights of rehearsal, so that I was invited to Garfield Harry's house. Helen Duran used to take me home with her. Robinette Harry, who was at Wilson Heaps, took me home with her. Mildred Taylor, whose home was over there on the other side of Highland, took me home with her. Whatever person was available to do it, so that I had some place to stay during the rehearsal, so that my father didn't have to drive back and forth all the time. And one of the final nights when the play was being given, Pop did come down this old, I guess it was a Model A, but I don't know. It was rickety like a Model T, but yeah. We came barrel. My father had just one way to drive a car. You aimed for the middle of the road and went just as hard as you could get. It didn't make it, as you could go, it didn't make any difference what was coming toward you or what was behind you. My father had the middle of the road, and that's where he stayed. And we were coming barreling down there from Highland, down there where Holzes is now, and of course there were no guardrails or anything around streams. And I don't know whether Pop just wasn't watching what he was doing or whether the old car swerved or what, but anyway, we made the turn before we got to it and went right down, nose down, in the ditch. There. This old car. A gang of kids came along and among them they could push it back out of there. That's how we finally got home. Mm-hmm. But Alice Richardson and I drove from up here where they called the sheep place, you know. Mm-hmm. Alice lived, well, she lived down where Abe Lowe is now. And we and the Kents lived there at the sheep place. And we all drove horse and buggy to Highland School. And you took enough corn in the back of your car to feed the horse at noontime. And there were sheds about as, oh, I would say they would be more than 100 feet long, where you could pull a buggy in and then take your horse out of the buggy and put him in a stall in front of it, and he stayed there until you were ready to go home that evening. And one day Alice and I had started to drive down to school. We had a storm that had the night before that had knocked some little some old trees down over some saplings and had bent the sapling right one of them right across the road. And I said, Alice said, we can't get past that. And I said, oh, Alice, I think if we give him a crack with a whip, he'll go through it. So Alice, she gave him a harder crack than I thought she was going to. And the horse just jumped right straight up. And the buggy went straddled the sapling and the single tree broke. And there we are sitting with the horse that the single tree is caved around and the horse is out of the shafts and Alice and I are sitting here in the buggy. Well, I don't remember how we finally got him tamed down enough that we could get him loose from the single tree and take him on into the school and put him in the stall, but we had to leave the buggy where it was. And that afternoon, after school was out, A.C. Strawbridge and Frank Linkus, both of whom were going to school too at that time, came, and they lived in the neighborhood, and they came out to fix us up so that we could get home. And Frank said, I think we can take that, we'll push the buggy back, get off the sapling, turn you around, let you go back, and I think we can tie the traces over the cross piece in the buggy shafts, and it'll get you home all right. So Frank and A.C. fixed this up somehow and tied it. And Alice and I started out home. Well, Alice was not very confident in their ability to fix up a rig. And every time we got to the top of a hill, Alice would say, well, thank God we're this far. This went on from Highland all the way back to Reynolds Mill over here on 136 now. So youngsters think of, you know, they think of the time when there were no plastics and no radios and no fancy equipment as having been probably an awful time to live, and in lots of ways it was. The good old days aren't all spit and polish. There was a lot of just plain hard work and a lot of discomfort. You just imagine riding from up here at Reynolds Mill on 136 to Highland would be, I guess it would be 8 miles, anyhow, maybe nine. And we rode down there rain and shine, because by this time compulsory education meant you better get there. Mm-hmm. And rain or shine, we hooked that old horse up to a buggy and snow or whatever and went to Highland. And we used to put a big stick of green wood in the oven of the cook stove, or a brick, whichever was more convenient for us to get hold of, and get it good and warm, and then put it in the bottom of the buggy, and we would start off. Well, of course, by the time we got to Five Forks, the brick was cold, and so were we, but you struggled on and went on to school. Mm-hmm. And then the last 2 years that I went to school, Alice had quit and gone to Baltimore, so I had to go by myself, and I decided rather than fool with the buggy, I was going to ride horseback. So I did, from Reynolds Mill to Highland School. I rode horseback every day in all kinds of weather. And Tommy Heaps, do you know Tommy, down here on Federal Hill Road?
Mm, I know the name.
Well, he was just a little kid when I was a senior. He must have been about the second or third grade, and they lived right there on the road. It's on, well, it's where 165 comes up from Pilesville. They live on top of the hill. And Tommy loved riding horseback, and so nearly every morning he would come running out there and wait for me to come by and pick him up, and I would pick him up and put him on the back of the horse, and we'd go to school together. So there were lots of things that youngsters think, oh, it'd be wonderful to do that now. And it is in nice sunny weather, and when everything's fine and your horse and your buggy doesn't break down, or your horse doesn't get sick, or all the things that could happen to him, it was fun. But it got a little old by the time you had finished 183 days. Hmm. But it was such a family affair then that it isn't now. Now, when I was in these plays, Miss Walbeck, who always directed them, thought it was a waste of time to drill kids as hard as she did for the 2 weeks to put on a play and then just give it one place. So we would give it wherever they had a hall. Forestville would have us down there in what used to be the old Oddfellows Hall, mm-hmm. and Stewartstown would have us up here in what was, I think, at one time maybe a Grange Hall, and we gave them in Fawn Grove. So after the play was ready to go on the road, like a Broadway production, somebody in the family just kind of got together and they made a schedule so that somebody in my family went to where the play was being given. And they set it up so that if one uncle was taking me to Stewartstown, another uncle was taking me to Forest Hill later, and another one to someplace else. And they felt a responsibility. You know, you felt a debt to them, and they felt a responsibility for you. And most, in fact, of the memories that I have of all the things that have to do with that are family-oriented for that reason, because everybody was involved in them. Mm-hmm. I remember when my two uncles owned their first touring cars, and they got in their heads that they were going to have a race to see which had the better touring car. So they went up to Fawn Grove, and they were going to run that straight stretch, which at that time was one of the few straight stretches, and it isn't rather straight, mm-hmm. from Fawn Grove to New Park. And my father and I were in the back seat of Uncle Milton's car. And I can't remember who was with Uncle Lee, but anyway, Pop and I are sitting here in the back seat. Well, at that time, the front seat had a rack on it that you could hang your coat over. So it was a very substantial sort of thing. It was almost like something that you might put along with your wall to pull yourself out of a bathtub. It had so much weight there. Bob and I were sitting in the back seat, and these two cars were going side by side, right heading for New Park, and on a road that hardly had more room enough for one car. And Pop was sitting back there hollering, "Milton, ain't you got no sense? Milton, ain't you got no sense? Hold on to the coat rack." Now, do you have more taking space?
Oh, yeah.
Then, of course, too, another thing that was a very important part of our daily lives were the old general stores, and there were a lot of them around. And most of the store trading was done either by the father or by the children in the family. Usually the children went to the store. They took a list. Mm-hmm. And you usually took eggs and sometimes butter, depending on whether the store bought butter, and most of them did. And you had a store list made up by your mother. I guess mothers were just too busy to go, or else the walk was better for the kids than it was for the parents. I don't know which. But we would go usually to the Strawbridge's store, which is down here on 136. In fact, we did most of the trading that we did there because it was closer than the other one. But there was another store down there at St. Mary's Church, and I guess those were the only two really close ones in our neighborhood. And they carried everything from children's shoes to syrup in a keg. Mm. And that's the way the syrup was sold. There was a big wooden keg, and it was filled with what is fair, like the king syrup that you buy now. Mm-hmm. Had a big crank on it and a plug that you opened, and then you turned your crank and the syrup would ooze out into whatever you had brought for a container for it. Sugar was sold in the same way. It was in a big barrel, and the sugar was dipped out into paper sacks that usually were in the store. Usually provided the paper sacks, although I think I can remember having taken sacks back now, whether we just took them because we wanted a particular thing in a particular paper sack, I don't know. And people gathered at the country stores. They were sort of, well, I don't know, I guess you would really call them just a regular social gathering hall, much the same way that they do now out here at Jesse Waldron's garage. They go out here to the garage in Norrisville and bat the breeze just about every day that didn't fit the work to farm around here. You can find four or five farmers out there. I'm talking now. And I just can't think of anything that I ever went to Sherman Strobridge's store to buy that he didn't have. From hair ribbons, he carried hair ribbons, he carried shoes, he carried shoelaces, he carried... Don't remember that he ever carried any ready-made women's clothes, but he carried overalls and shirts for men. And he carried clocks. I don't remember if he ever carried watches or not, but a lot of the small stores did. And then he had over the top of the store was a hall where any kind of local organization that existed in the neighborhood could have meetings. And I know that the Rebecca and Oddfellow Lodges were very new when we first came up here. And I always thought my father was a kind of frustrated performer because he was always organizing some kind of shows that we did in this hall. And one of the things that he loved to fool with what was called tableau lights. Now, I don't suppose you've ever seen one, because I haven't seen one for years and years and years, but it was some kind of little carbon kind of thing that you lit, and it had all different colors. If you wanted somebody to look dead, you lit blue, and if you wanted them to look extremely angry, you lit an orange or a red. And my father was fascinated by certain poems, and usually they would be poems that had to do with the kind of thing that you get in country western songs now, you know, love, death, and persecution. And I remember there was one that was called The Little Match Girl. And it was had some kind of poem or song with it that told about how she stood on the rich man's steps and looked at his pot of gold, and she was freezing to death, you know, and she was dying right before their eyes. Well, of course, as I say, I started being a ham very young, so my father always put me in the roles where you had to be very, very dramatic, and he picked me out to die on the rich man's step in this hall above Sherman Strobridge's store. And my brother Gret, who was then about 5, maybe 6 years old, was sitting on the front seat. And when I came out shivering and trembling and fell down dead on the steps, and the blue tableau lights came up, and I was all white, Gret jumped up off the front seat and came over and grabbed me by the shoulders and hollered, Floor, wake up, wake up! Needless to say, my dramatic moment was lost right there. So they would get together and figure out their own plays. They did all kinds of just real clever things that you look back on them even now when you've seen a lot of things that are supposed to be lots better. Mm-hmm. I don't think you had much more fun than we had doing those, especially since nearly everything that they did was related to or referred to somebody that you knew. Mm-hmm. So that there was meaning to it. You related to everything anybody did. In fact, when we were kids, we used to put on our own plays in the kitchen, and we were always doing some stupid thing. Even after we were, I guess we were in our teens. And my father was a great person to, if he rested, he never rested in a chair. He stretched out someplace. And if he didn't have a couch, excuse me, he would put two chairs together and stretch out on them. And one time, he wasn't feeling very well, and he had put his two chairs up by the cook stove. And sort of crawled halfway behind it. The cook stove sat out a good piece from the wall, and he was very comfortable back in there on these chairs with a blanket rolled up under him. And we were going to do an old story. I guess it was Jack and the Beanstalk, because it's the one where he says, "Fish fly, folks, for my smell the blood of an Englishman," you know. And Rex went over and shook Pop's foot and said, "Hey, Pop, wake up. We need a giant. All you've got to say is, food, blood, food, Pop, I smell the blood of an Englishman." Pop said, "Dang, nab your souls, I'll see if I go from you." We never did get a giant. We had to go on playing without one. But it was, you know, that sort of thing that I think maybe kept families closer together than we have a chance to be now, when so many children especially are so involved in almost professional sports, you know, things that you have to have a lot of training for. And youngsters have got to the feeling now that you can't do it unless somebody spends a lot of time teaching you how to do it, no matter what it is. And I think that's too bad, because as I talk to youngsters now in elementary schools about the kinds of things that I did as a child, you can see them just itching to do something for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the other day, Narsville had a cute little thing for their youngsters. They had Stepping Stone. They asked Stepping Stone to send a craftsman who would show these youngsters very simple things that a child could go home and do. And then the parents who were putting the show on took each craft that we were demonstrating and drew out a page of instructions with every design on that we were going to talk about. For instance, I was talking about how to make dolls out of corn cobs. And they sketched that corn cob doll and showed exactly how to make it and how to dress it, everything about it that a child would need to know. Then they put all this in a little book the child could take home with him. Well, one of the things that they were teaching them was to weave on a little frame that they cut out of cardboard for themselves. And Beth, my six-year-old granddaughter, came home with one of the frames, and she was sitting here working with it and having a real good time with it, but her thread kept getting tangled. And she said, "Isn't there some way you can keep it from tangling, Gaga?" And I said, "Well, I think if you would roll it in a ball, just start real easy and roll the ball up, that the ball will unroll without tangling when you're taking it off of the large piece of yarn, it won't." So she rolled the ball up, and then you could just see the wheels going around in her head, and she said, "Gaga, do you have a plastic cup?" And I gave her a plastic cup, and she took something, I think it was the end of a knife, and punched a hole close to the bottom of the plastic cup, put her ball yarn in there, and pulled the strand out through that. So she had a perfect setup. She could just pull it out of there, however she believed it was. She was as happy as if she had discovered gold in California. And we have done a lot of taking too much of that out of the lives of children. They're not allowed to discover learning.
Mm-hmm.
So much of it, I guess we get pressured, I know I was when I taught, pressured by the things they needed to know, so that we don't give them time to discover what they want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of pity, because it seems to me the one thing that, as I talk to children these days, that they covet most from my childhood is that I had time, and they don't.
Hmm.
I had time to lie flat on my back and look at clouds sailing overhead, or I had time to just sit and dream and do nothing. And they don't. They're structured, you know. They have so much of music and so much of sports and so much of dancing and so much of recreation and so much of family night that I wonder how they ever get time to get through all this.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to shut us off for a minute so we'll get something. And I guess that my school teaching experience was as unique as anybody else's in the county, because I think that I am the first teacher who was hired to a consolidated school without having served some time in a one-room school first. Now, I've never gone to check the records on that, but I'm almost reasonably sure that I was the first one hired for a consolidated school. And to show you how dumb I was when I was ready to ask for a job, Mr. Wright had known me all my life, of course, and I went into his office and said, president of the college at Salisbury had said to me, "Now, Miss Hankins, we're sure that we can place you in Baltimore County, which is a better salary than you're going to get in Hartford. So you just go and tell Milton Wright that if he doesn't put you in Jerseyville, you're going to Baltimore County." Well, of course, he thought this is a big joke, you know, so what do I do? Dumb. I walk in and I say, "Mr. Wright, I'd like to have Jerseyville, but if you're not going to send me to Jerseyville, I'm going to Baltimore County." Mr. Wright said, "Flora, I'm going to hire you, but hiring an all-A student is really against my better judgment, or a 4-H club star either." And I said, "Mr. Wright, why?" You know, I who was so proud of all my A's, and he said, "Because an all-A student never knows how a C student gets it. And a 4-H club star won't give up the center of the stage himself." Now, wasn't that good teaching? And I said that was the biggest lesson that I learned in connection with my teaching, because I thought, every time you begin to think how easy this thing is to you, you have to see how it looks to the guy on the other side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started at Jerseyville in 30. and I had a sixth and seventh grade. And before I left Jerseyville to go to Highland in 44, I guess it was, my last class had 56 youngsters in the two classes. Miss Nettle was my supervisor, and she came in one day, and Miss Nettle always sort of talked through her nose, and she said, "Fall, the next time I come in here, I expect to see them hanging from the chandelier." But you know, a friend of mine who started the same year I did, and I were talking about that not long ago, and she had just given a talk to a teacher's group and told them that, about having had 40 children in one room. And they said, "Well, weren't you constantly frustrated?" And Izzy said, "Well, no, I really wasn't. I either was so glad to have a job that I wasn't complaining, or I was too dumb to know better." And I don't know what it was. Because, of course, having come out right in the heart of the Depression, you know, we were lucky to get jobs. I think less than a third of my class was placed. Mm. And these were people who had intensive training in the old normal schools, and we had intensive training. We began practice teaching in the second semester. There were three semesters a year. Second semester of your first year, you began practice teaching, and you did practice teaching every semester till you were graduated. Mm. And of course, we had this dean of women who taught one of the introduction to teaching classes, and her favorite phrase was, "Now I know it's going to look all right to you here, but wait till you are in front of that class with 40 pairs of little eyes looking at you." Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way it was. You got a first day of school when you looked, and there were 40 pairs of little eyes looking at you. But in Jarrettsville, they were friendly little eyes, and I said, if everybody had been treated the way I was treated, all my teaching years, but especially the first dozen teaching years, everybody would love teaching. If youngsters were having a Sunday school picnic, or if they were having something special at home, they took you home with them. And you stayed all night, and you did all the things that they did, and you were treated like you were somebody very, very special. Mm-hmm. And, I have seventh graders that I taught in that first class. One of them's living in California, who calls me about two or three times a year, urging me to come out to California and spend 3 weeks at their place. One of them is teaching here in one of those youngsters in that first class is teaching here in Narsville School. And one of them is, she's a little later than the first class, but I am among my first classes, and there's another one who lives in Towson with whom I keep in close touch all the time. They were just good to you. There isn't any other way to say it. If you had to punish a child, and it was very seldom that you did, in those first years that I taught at Jarrettsville, from 30 till I moved from there, and I went to Highland in 30. I went back to school in 35 and came back, started in Highland then, and stayed there for a while, and then went back to Jarrettsville. But from 30 to 35, I paddled one youngster, and you just didn't. They just did what you told them to do, mm-hmm. And they were so good to you. The first year that I was there, my birthday's in March, and that first class, on the 18th of March, I thought it was funny that everybody was sort of standing around, almost giggling behind his hand. That's what it looked like, you know. But I still didn't think of anything different about it. Mm-hmm. And at noontime on that day, they opened we had a vestibule in the back of the room that ran the full width of the teaching room and had two doors in it, and a lot of shelves where they kept their lunch boxes in there. And they opened the doors of the vestibule at noontime and called me back there. And they had a whole birthday party set up. Huh. They had the cake, they had everything that you would have for any kind of fancy birthday party. Huh. And they gave me a little necklace that I still have, that they had somehow collected their money and got one of the parents to go buy it for. And there was just never a time when they weren't doing something like that for you. Mm-hmm. And they had, when they played on the playground, I played with them. You weren't assigned playground duty. The principal didn't care whether you went out or not. But they were just good kids, and you went out and had a good time with them. And of course, I was longer legged than any of them, and I used to race them across the athletic field and win. I wouldn't be able to get halfway across the field now. And I think that their desire to please you was one of the things that made teaching such a satisfaction. See, if I were to name a lot of the people who were in that class, Carl Ashfelt and Bob Ford and Catherine Kerr, they're people that you would recognize, you know, as being very substantial community people right now. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make teaching happy for you, and they also knew that if they gave the teacher a bad time, they were going to get a bad time when they got home. Mm-hmm. And the parents lived up to that. They just did. I had followed Mary Kay Smith, who was the 6th and 7th grade teacher before I went there. And I used to, when I would get stuck on something that wasn't working right, or that I didn't know how to work out, I went up to Mary Kay's, and she always straightened me out and told me how she thought it would work. And if she said it would, it usually did. And then, of course, when I went back there teaching high school, I followed Jen Smith, who had retired, all in the same family, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I taught Jen's son, Jim Smith, both at Jarrettsville and North Hartford. And by the way, he just died of cancer just within the last month. And they made such an effort to make things pleasant for you that you didn't mind working on till 6 o'clock in the evening or whatever time it took to get things ready for the next day. And when we had a Christmas program, we had no auditorium, you know, the old school had no auditorium in. But we gave all the plays in the Grange Hall down in the village, which was down near where the Methodist Church is now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I took all 40 or 50 or however many youngsters I had at that time, the whole blessed class, and we all trudged out from the school and walked down to the middle of Jarrettsville, which is, what, a mile anyhow, isn't it? Me with 40 or 45 or 50 kids, whichever it happened to be, to go down in that hall and rehearse our Christmas program until it was ready to put on. And one year we did Dickens' Christmas Carol, and Selman Garrison, who is a very wonderful surgeon in Baltimore City now, was Scrooge, and I can remember him to this day. He wasn't a very big kid, but he could really sound like a Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often, as I think back, I wonder what I did with the rest of those kids while the 20 or so of them were in there rehearsing, but I'm sure that whatever it was that I did with them, they weren't out running the roads and they didn't do anything in the neighborhood that anybody ever fussed about, because that's the way we operated.
Hmm.
And whoever in the neighborhood you needed to come and do anything for you, all you had to do was ask them. William Brown had a fantastic collection of dolls and a fantastic collection of historical information on the community, and you could call Miss Lillian any time, and she would come up to a history class, or she would come up to any kind of class to show her dolls and bring the whole thing for you. You could call Mary Risto if you needed anything political, and she would come and do the whole bit for you. In fact, the first seventh grade class that I had wanted a commencement exercise, so we had a commencement exercise, and Miss Mary was their speaker. And it was quite an affair, and very formally handled, and everything was, I mean, we went according to oil. They had, after you had taught a half year, examinations were sent out from Bel Air, and each youngster had to pass with about 75%, or he couldn't go into the next grade. And it was they were pretty firm about it. In fact, they were very firm about that until, oh, I don't know, I think I was teaching at Highland when they sort of got the thing back to where the teacher made up her own examinations. And I remember that year, one of the boys in my seventh grade class just did not seem like eighth grade material to me. So I went in and said to Mr. Wright, "Mr. Wright, I will be glad to mark on his report card, graduated but not promoted." I said, "He is not ready for eighth grade. I'm willing for him to leave seventh." This was before all youngsters went on to high school. "Willing for him to leave seventh, but he cannot do eighth grade work." And Mr. Wright said, "Now, Flora, it is very hard for us to sit here and look at a 12-year-old boy and say he can't do that ever. I don't believe it's possible for us to say that this child can never do eighth grade. So you just decide whether you want to fail him and have him repeat seventh, or whether you're going to let him go on to eighth." And it was very impressive to me that the night that boy graduated from high school, the year he graduated from high school, I sat in the audience the night he played the lead in the senior play and did the best job of anybody I'd ever seen in high school. So I knew that you, when you had a superintendent like Mr. Wright, you could rely on his judgment because he'd been around and he knew. And then, of course, I was there when Dr. Willis came to be superintendent. And the second year that he was there, he assigned me an all-boys science class. And of course, I was not only English major, but I was never science-oriented. And I went storming into the office and I said, Dr. Willis, I cannot do this science class. These kids are going to study automobiles, and they know more about automobiles when they were born than I'm ever going to know all my life. And I was carrying on striping. And Dr. Willis, you know, you never could quite tell whether he was looking at you or not, because he had a cast in one eye, and you never knew exactly which eye was on you. And he said, now, Mrs. Whiting, I have to look at this county as if it were a baseball team. You may not be the best pitcher. If I need a pitcher, I got to have a pitcher. You may not be the best pitcher I can pick, but you're the only pitcher I have available. He said, you may not know a thing about automobiles, but you know a lot about kids. And so you're just going to have to get in there and teach ninth grade boys automobile, even if you have to read the night before what you know about automobiles. And you know, I thought when I came out of there, this makes an awful lot of sense. You know, we're so prone to think that if we're specialized in a thing, we have to be paid for that specialty and we can't get away from the specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kill a lot of initiative in teachers and kids too.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught automobiles, and I did exactly what Dr. Bill said I would have to do. I read the night before what we were going to do with it. Well, this same class that I was teaching automobiles to got in their heads that they weren't going to do geography. They couldn't see any reason in the world for learning geography, because the world was already here when they got here, and it would probably be here when they were gone, and there wasn't a bit of use in their spending time on it. And I said, well, okay, what do you want to learn? They wanted to learn sports. Everything they could know about sport. See, this is an all-boys class. So I said, well, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll go home tonight, and I'll take the sports page, and I'll make a test on it. And if you can pass it, then we'll learn sports and forget geography. Of course, the joker was that I knew the Olympics were on, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that there would be more geography on the sports page than there was sports if you were looking for it. So I made my test, and it was all on the sports page, every bit of it. And I took the paper in to prove it, because you couldn't tell them anything. You had to prove it. And I took the paper in with them, and I gave them their test. And, of course, they all flunked it, because I had based the questions all on the geography of the Olympics rather than on who was the champion for what. But, you know, those kids were good about it. After I showed them the paper and showed them where I got my test questions, our bargain was a bargain. So we did geography, and we did it. They were very good about it and did very well with it. So, I guess, I'm sure that sort of thing is still going on in schools everywhere, but I think sometimes that we have got so many people who don't know each other well enough for it to be a fun thing, see?
Mm-hmm.
When I did that with those kids, it was fun. They got as big a kick out of the fact that I had pulled one over on them as they would have if they'd pulled one over on me, which they frequently did, believe me. They won as many times as I did, more often most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went from elementary school to teaching high school after I came back to teaching after Jim was born. Then I started at North Hartford. And I was thinking the other day how different North Hartford has to be now from what it was when I began there. Because when I began at North Hartford in the fall of 50, I could take my POD class. I could say to Mr. Powell, which I did, say to Mr. Powell, I was to coach the senior play. And I said, Mr. Powell, the only way that I know to get flats built for that stage is take the POD class out and build them. And that's exactly what we did. We got out on the campus up there back of the auditorium, laid our boards out, and nailed them all together. And Mr. Fuller bought the canvas and sized it, and the boys stretched it and put it on there, and I helped them nail it up, and we put it up and put our play on. The auditorium hadn't got its curtains yet, So we had to, the only way we could work the play was that it was in three acts, of course. And so when the end of the first and second act, we turned all the lights out and changed the scenery in the dark. And there was some kind of personal involvement in that sort of thing that made youngsters feel closer to it than they can possibly feel to anything that they have in school now, because so much of it is done for them. Mm-hmm. That same crowd, when we did get the old velvet curtain, it was a beautiful old green and gold curtain, you know, with the school seal in the center of it. And when these new fireproof regulations came on and had to be changed to some kind of fireproof plastic, they took the old curtains down. And my kids asked for them. I was teaching Bo Tech then. They asked for them and got them. And they tore them in little squares and sold them for souvenirs. And we used the money to put a memorial window in the for our boys who were killed in Vietnam. And those youngsters felt very important because they were contributing, they were taking something out of their past that would bring something into their future. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what there is about our change that has, I'm sure youngsters are probably better, I started to say better educated, but I think the word's better trained. I'm sure they're probably better trained in academics and they're better trained in much the school involves, but I don't believe they're quite so personally involved mm-hmm. as they were in those days. And for instance, our auditorium wasn't open at North Hartford, I mean our gymnasium wasn't open at North Hartford till almost, well it must have been 6 months after we got in there, because it was basketball season, I know, when they opened it. And they were having some kind of affair in the gym that meant it had to be decorated. Maybe it was a Halloween, I mean a Valentine thing. But anyway, one of the boys who had counted, he had trudged off to Slate Ridge to practice basketball all those weeks and weeks that we were in there. Mm-hmm. And then to find that they couldn't get it the first time it was open because they were going to have a dance or something. And I remember he just took his fist and hit the towel. Hard enough that I thought he'd break a bone in his fist. I said, "What in the world's the matter with you, child?" And he said, "It's all these weeks of trudging off the slave ridge and then come to find out we can't use it the first night it's out of the prison." So, I used to say to Mr. Powell that if school doesn't do a thing for a youngster except give him something that will make him remember that he's been there, then it has served its purpose. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that nobody who was ever at North Hartford in the years of 56, 57, 58 will remember the time that, will forget the time that Dave Duran and Neil DeVoe and Bob Clark put the buggy on top of school. And I'm sure that the class of, let's see, would be 50, class of 57, I guess, 56 or 57, they were doing, no, it was earlier than that. They were doing theme term papers for me. And jokingly, and smart mouth, you know, the way you roll with kids sometimes, I said, "Now your deadline is midnight, March the 18th. And anybody whose paper comes in after midnight, March the 18th, will not get it looked at, because I will not look at it, blah, 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 you know, go on." Well, a group of these kids got together. They had a big fun to organize it so that somebody came into my house every 15 minutes from dark until midnight. And that's what they did. I've forgotten who brought the last paper in, but it was just barely midnight, but they kept me up till midnight delivering those papers. And the same thing, then there were another class, I think that was 58. I was fussing at them about staying out all night for the prom, you know, and I said, "For the Lord's sake, get yourselves in time so that you're not going to be on the road when it's dangerous or dangerous for you to drive," and you know, the kind of lecture you always give them. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten how it came up, but anyway, they said they were going to prove to me that they would be in the daylight. And I said, "And how are you going to do that?" And they said, "We're coming up to have breakfast with you." And I said, but about Ross milked, you know, at that time, he would get up about 4 o'clock to start to barn the milk. And it was shortly after Ross got up that we could see headlights begin to come in the lane. There were 8 carloads of them. who showed up for breakfast. So I had to get out of bed and make pancakes. So for a carload of kids. But those kids are all still around, and they're fantastic kinds of citizens now, and you just kind of are glad that some of the things that they did at school are things that they're going to remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be more meaningful that they outwitted the teacher and made it at 4 o'clock to cook for them than it would be to go to the nicest nightclub they can find in Baltimore,
mm-hmm,
and spend 2 or 3 hours, or 4 or 5 hours, and then drive home. So I guess the difference in teaching then and now is largely the personal involvement,
mm-hmm,
of the teacher and a student, and students with each other. They could think of things to do to each other that you wouldn't believe. I remember one time when Neil DeVoe and Dave Duran and Bob Clark and Sturgill and that crowd were all in one class, and their shop teacher didn't show up, and they were just having a ball. They sneaked over to the classroom. The school's in an L, you know, and they sneaked into a classroom on one side of the L, and they were, I don't know whether they were throwing paper, wads of paper or what, or whether they were just attracting the attention of the class in the other half of the L, but the other kids could see them. The kids could see each other, and they were just having a real good time. And Mr. Pyle came walking down the hall behind the ones who were making all the mischief, you know, and he just stood there and waited till every one of them hanged himself. And then he got them. Well, they don't forget that. They, you know, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm,
is a thing that stays with them, and they've had fun at it and doing it, and they even have fun when they're caught. There isn't anything that I know of that used to delight kids more. When I was teaching, I used to say to the seniors, when they did something they weren't supposed to do, I would say, "Now you've just been down to your britches, you're tight." And when they did, then I just took my hand and fanned their bottoms. Well, of course you wouldn't be able to do that these days, but nothing delighted those kids more than for me to say that to somebody, and they would tell on each other, you know, to try to get me to do it. And then we had a thing going at North Hartford that was, I gave a nickel to anybody who made a truly bright remark, and they were called Wiley Nickels, and they would take them down to the shop and drill a hole in them and wear them on the chain or whatever, you know, because it was big fun to win a Wiley nickel. But we had a thing going that if you tried to be funny, the nickels were called for witty remarks, and if you tried to be funny and it fell flat, it was called half witty remarks. So they were always afraid to try too much.